From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We never take that for granted. We're very grateful for all the support we get, and we want to say thank you to each one of you individually. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, July 9th is the Baha'i observance of the martyrdom of the Bab. It's also the Buddhist Asalaha Puja Day. Tuesday is the Orthodox Christian Feast of All Saints, and Thursday brings the start of the three-day Shinto remembrance of ancestors called Oban. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
President Trump said today, any negative poll is fake news.
Call me old-fashioned, but I still believe there's something as a verifiable fact and truth.
Call it the war on facts. In some quarters of government, we're seeing unprecedented levels of undermining confidence in, well, in everything. It's as if the source, any source of a piece of information is inherently political. And if I don't like that piece of information, all I need to do is discredit the source to make the inconvenient fact, poof, disappear. Luckily, we've never played by those kinds of rules around here. Striving to present objective, reliable, unbiased data, we turn to the Public Religion Research Institute on a regular basis. And we do so again today because a new report of findings from the PRRI American Values Atlas offers remarkable challenges to today's contemporary wisdom of what majorities of Americans want and believe. On this week's show, I'll talk with PRRI Director of Research, Daniel Cox.
Let us pray for the salvation of all of those who live in that totalitarian darkness. Pray they will discover the joy of knowing God. But until they do, they are the focus of evil in the modern world.
It's a lucky book author who produces something that people are still passing around a year after publication. It's even more remarkable when an opinion column, even a New York Times opinion column, continues to garner attention a year after it first appeared. Such is the case with a piece headlined, How Should We Respond to Evil? From late June of 2016, and I'm looking forward to welcoming the author, the Reverend Stephen Polikas, to this week's show. But first,
was America founded as a Christian nation, and what was the worldview of the founding fathers that ultimately gave birth to this American experiment?
The Bible is what gives liberty, and the further away you get from the Bible, the further away from liberty you'll get. You look at any nation in the world that is not biblical, not liberty.
We've covered the growing number of Americans who claim no religious affiliation, the so-called nones, repeatedly on this show. However, please don't take the fact that there is now an exhibit of religious history in the nation's capital to mean that religion in this country is now extinct. Just as importantly, please don't think this is yet another faith-driven pseudo-scientific theme park like the notorious Ark Encounter in Kentucky. No, the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History Religion section is an exhaustive, scientific, and invaluable look at the role of faiths, and its curator is the esteemed scholar Peter Manceau. And I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Manceau back to State of Belief Radio. Peter, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Would you talk about why you were interested in curating the Smithsonian's religious section?
I have the privilege of being the first curator of religion at the National Museum of American History. There have certainly been curators before me who have had an interest in religion, and so I'm not starting from scratch in terms of religious objects in the Smithsonian's collection. But this is the first time that the American History Museum has had a dedicated curator of American religious history. And I'm thrilled to have this opportunity because in my writing, I've always been drawn to objects. The material culture of the past has always felt to me the most direct connection we can have to lives that are so far gone, to beliefs and practices that might seem too far distant in the past to have direct access to without something concrete to hold on to. Mm-hmm. So the ability to tell this story in a place like the Smithsonian, which not only has its own incomparable collections of millions of objects to draw upon, but also as an institution with which other institutions and communities of faith were so eager to work with to lend us significant materials for the exhibit, it was just an opportunity too good to pass up. And so it's been a thrill. These past 2 years, I've been trying to collect objects that relate to the great diversity of religious life in early America so that visitors will see some expected and stories that they may have heard about during their schooling, and also some real surprises. So a blending of the known and the unknown to tell this surprising story of religion in early America was really the goal.
And, you know, Peter, I have to say that I run into a lot of people regularly who have no idea that there was diversity in the beginning of America's religions.
Well, I think when we are growing up and we learn anything, if we learn anything about America's early religious history, we learn about the Pilgrims or we might learn about the Puritans. We learn this phrase that Governor John Winthrop of the Puritans taught to history, a city upon a hill, a phrase, of course, borrowed from the New Testament that then he applies to the American experiment. Mm-hmm. It's a phrase that's used by John F. Kennedy, and then most significantly by Ronald Reagan, and then Barack Obama echoed it as well. And the result of this idea that America is a city upon a hill as far as its religious history goes, I think has convinced many people that it's just one story, mm-hmm. that there's only the story of the persecution of a certain type of English Protestant that came across the Atlantic to live their faith as they saw fit. But that story overlooks the fact that we are actually many cities and many hills. Almost simultaneously in the 17th century, as the Pilgrims and the Puritans are arriving, you have a great many different communities of faith crossing the Atlantic and encountering a continent already full of a diversity of beliefs and practices. And within a generation, they're also bringing by force men and women from Africa with their own religious traditions. Mm-hmm. So from that very earliest moment of encounter of all these different cultures, religious diversity is the real story of American religious history.
Give us a quick visit through the religion section and tell our listeners what they will find in the American religion section in the museum.
The Religion in Early America exhibit covers roughly 1630 to 1830, so 200 years of early American history from both the colonial period and then the first few decades of the early republic. Within this section, we consider three factors: religious diversity, as I've mentioned, religious freedom as a direct outgrowth of that diversity, as a practical need for so many different competing and conflicting religious worldviews to create a society together. We needed to have no official religion and resulting religious liberty. And contrary to what many feared at the time, this religious liberty did not lead to the decline of religion as a cultural or moral force, but the opposite happens. We have these periods of blossomings of religious devotion known as Great Awakenings early in American history, and those three factors contribute to the very uniquely religious nation that we have today. And this is, of course, a story that we tell with objects. And so the earliest objects in the exhibit do relate to the history of the Puritans. We have the Bay Psalm Book, which is the first book published in English North America, an edition of the Psalms published in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1640. And the fascinating thing about this object to me is not only that it's first, but also what it represents. It suggests that religion in early America was had an improvised nature from the start. When the Puritans arrived and they wanted to purify their faith, they saw the need to create a new translation of the Psalms, to have new words of worship for this new land. And so they gathered a community of 30 scholars to translate the Hebrew Psalms into a metrical, a verse English. And it was a real statement of breaking new ground in this land that they called a New Jerusalem. And we put that story in context with some of the immediate religious disagreements that occurred within the society that tried to be theologically uniform. So, for example, we include an object owned by Roger Williams, who was exiled from Massachusetts for his heretical religious ideas and wanders through southern New England looking for a place to found a colony of his own, the colony of Providence, which some point to as the real seedbed of religious freedom in this country. To tell Roger Williams' story, we actually have a sundial compass that he used to wander through the woods and find his way for this place where he would establish his own colony. So the objects in the exhibit are not only explicitly religious objects like the Bay Psalm book, they're also very active objects, like this sundial compass, which despite not being a liturgical object or anything directly related to worship, becomes very important to our earliest religious history.
You know, Peter, I'm always interested in how that history relates to some of the debates and complexity of the present. And I'd like for you, if you will, just to talk for a second about the multiplicity of religions that are involved in this and how that really does relate to where we are now.
The story of religion in early America, as many have encountered it, is largely a story of diversity among different Protestant denominations. And that is, of course, part of the story we tell as well. You have, from the very earliest days, you have the Puritans who become a congregational church. In the southern colonies, you have the Anglicans, which become the Episcopal Church. And then a variety of other Protestant denominations become part of the story as it unfolds. Roger Williams establishes the First Baptist Church in Rhode Island. The Dutch Reform are coming into New Amsterdam all around the same time. The Quakers, driven out of Massachusetts, established themselves in Pennsylvania. But the bigger story is that it's not simply a matter of these Protestant denominations vying for places to have their individual colonies and eventually competing for members in their churches. From the early part of the middle of the 17th century, there's also a Catholic population who arrives in Maryland in the 1630s. And not too much later, the first organized Jewish community arrives in New Amsterdam, later New York. And all the while, we do have, as a really forgotten part of our history, the forced importation of African beliefs and practices, which include perhaps a dozen regional religious systems from West Africa, as well as Islam. The presence of Islam in early America will likely be the most surprising thing to many people who visit the exhibit or read the book. But it's among scholars and historians, it's a non-controversial fact of our history that perhaps 15-20% of the enslaved men and women brought to America had some connection to Islam when they arrived. All of these transplanted traditions are negotiating with a world where there's already a diversity of beliefs and practices here in Native America. There was not simply just one Native American way of being religious. There's a whole continent full of beliefs and practices which differ by region and by language group and by experience. So that's really the story, the intersection of all those beliefs and practices that on the surface don't seem to have much to do with each other, but then through their interaction change each other dramatically. The story is not simply Christianity coming in and suppressing all these other faiths. That it is certainly part of it, but both the majority faith and the minority faith are changed in the process.
The past decade has seen a great deal of revisionist history, particularly when it comes to the role of religion. So how do you navigate those waters?
That's really the power of working with objects. Working with objects is significantly different, and I think more immediate than making a written argument. Mm-hmm. A written argument often cannot persuade those who believe in a counter-narrative, who may be invested in these revisionist histories to which you're referring. But the documents and objects themselves in the exhibit they really do speak for themselves, and they are undeniable. I mentioned that the presence of Islam in early America, both in the exhibit and the book, will seem controversial to some, but to scholars, it is taken as a fact. In the exhibit, we have a 13-page Arabic document written by an enslaved Muslim in Georgia early in the 19th century. It includes some basic information about the practice of Islam. It was written as an attempt by this enslaved man to pass his faith along despite the circumstances. And so there's really no refuting an object like this. There's no denying the presence of Islam in early America when you're faced with this. And the same is true with objects from other traditions that are in the exhibit. They tell a story themselves. Objects have a wonderful way of acting as almost like photographs, a freeze frame of a moment in time. And the object I'm thinking about just now as I say that is a Torah scroll with a history bound up in the American Revolution. There was a small but vibrant Jewish community at the time of the Revolution, and during the British occupation of Manhattan in 1776, Hessian soldiers occupied the sanctuary of a synagogue, Sheareth Israel, in Manhattan, and at one point set it on fire and damaged this Torah scroll. In the exhibit, as well as in the book, you can see the burn marks in this scroll that was saved. And that tells a great deal about the history of a minority religious community, about their presence and their resilience and their desire to be part of the American experiment at the time of the nation's founding. Faced with objects, one often needs to confront assumptions about history, including the alternate histories that they may have learned.
Why is it important to study the role of religion in the nation's history?
Well, it's important to remember that these questions that we face today about religious diversity, they've always been part of the American question. What kind of nation do we want to be? Who gets to call themselves Americans? And so to confront our past and to see that our forebears have also dealt with these questions and not dealt with them perfectly, the establishment of religious freedom was not inevitable. It was not immediate. Even when the First Amendment guaranteed religious freedom at the federal level, established churches continued to exist at the state level, and it was only a matter of decades for those to be repealed. And so the notion that wrestling with questions of religious freedom and religious diversity is a real part of this American experiment, I think, is important to remember now as we're faced with these current questions, which seem so intractable, and yet when we look back at them, we'll see them as part of an ongoing story, this work in progress of trying to get religious freedom right.
When a person comes to this museum, what do you want that person to experience in the religion section at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History to take with them when they go?
Most people who come to an exhibit like this, I think, will come in looking for themselves. They'll want to know if their religious identity, their community, is represented. And many people, most people, I think, will find that when they come looking, whether they're seeing George Washington's Anglican christening robe or a bell that Paul Revere made for a congregational church, or the Torah scroll I mentioned, or that Arabic document, or an object we didn't mention, Thomas Jefferson's somewhat heretical edition of the Bible, in which he edited with a razor blade. Mm. There's a lot for people to identify with and to see themselves in their own religious perspective within the exhibit. But the real power is seeing that all of these are part of the same American story. No matter how different each worldview is suggested by the objects, they're all part of the same story. And so I like to think that they will inspire conversations between those who find themselves in the exhibit space, and it will lead to greater understanding.
Dr. Peter Manso is curator of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History Religion section in Washington, D.C. You'll get an in-depth look at this important exhibit in Dr. Manso's new book, Objects of Devotion, Religion in Early America. Peter's other books include One Nation Under Gods, A New American History. Peter, it's always great to talk with you. I'm so glad that it's you that has this immensely important position at the Smithsonian. Thanks also for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
My genuine pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from a faith leader who has spent a great deal of time Pondering the Concept of Evil, the Reverend Stephen Polikas. And up next, Public Religion Research Institute Director of Research, Daniel Cox. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. We're a divided nation. There's no question about that. Part of the reason is there are concrete efforts to divide us for political advantage. At the same time, there's a lot for us to disagree about right now. What's critical at a time like this is objective, unbiased truth. Facts based not on an agenda, but on scientific research. Our friends at the Public Religion Research Institute offer exactly that on a regular basis, and some remarkable findings from the American Values Atlas bring PRRI Director of Research Daniel Cox back to State of Belief Radio today. Dr. Cox, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Well, one of the headlines that stood out for me is the percentage of Americans who oppose anti-gay religious exemptions. This is particularly noteworthy because these kinds of exemptions have been a cornerstone for political religious right organizing in recent years. Would you talk about your findings on exemptions, please?
This is a question we've asked for a couple years, and we found that generally there's really no religious group with a majority supporting this idea of allowing small business owners to refuse services or products to gay and lesbian people, even if doing so violates standing religious beliefs. We're sort of approaching a consensus, and not just on this issue, but same-sex marriage as well. Now, there's still divides between Republicans and Democrats and more conservative religious groups from a more moderate and progressive ones. But we're really approaching, I think, agreement on these long-standing sort of fraught cultural question. And at a time when, as you mentioned, we're divided over so much in this country, it's really kind of notable that on these issues, we are getting closer to agreement.
Do you see major differences in the numbers based on geography, religious affiliation, or other characteristics in talking about this?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're looking at same-sex marriage, not surprisingly, you know, states that make up the Bible Belt, Deep South, Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, parts of Appalachia, they tend to be most opposed to legalization of same-sex marriage, whereas the coastal states, Washington State, Oregon, California, and states in the Northeast, New England, and parts of the Mid-Atlantic tend to be most supportive.
Are the numbers on this issue about the same over the last 3 to 5 years?
No, one of the things that's really interesting and notable is that we're actually seeing a pretty significant movement. From roughly 2012, 13, 14, we had a sort of bare majority in support of same-sex marriage, but we saw a significant jump between 2015 and 2016. In 2015, only 53% said they supported it, and 2016, we're up near 6 in 10, 58% said they supported allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry legally. So we're seeing a pretty remarkable shift.
Mm-hmm. Well, discrimination comes up in another section of this research, and I know you've been tracking the amount of discrimination different groups see in our society. Would you talk about what you saw in terms of this, and are there changes from past years about discrimination generally?
Yeah, so this was really interesting. So this is the first time we've asked these questions on the American Values Atlas, although we've asked these questions in other surveys in previous years. And what we see when we ask these kind of questions is that Americans are really divided on this issue, and we're almost living in two different countries. You know, our reality is really being mediated by our religion, by our politics. So while you see Democrats and people who are religious and affiliated and members of non-Christian religious traditions are really likely to say that African Americans, immigrants, and gay and lesbian people face a lot of discrimination in society, we see that white evangelical Protestants and Mormons and Republicans express much greater doubts about whether those groups face discrimination.
Hmm. Another issue that's been a political football involves access to public bathrooms for transgender persons. What did you find on that?
We found that there's actually more agreement among particularly the political groups that transgender people are facing a lot of discrimination. So the partisan gap on perceptions of discrimination is actually larger when you're talking about gay and lesbian people than transgender people, where there's more agreement among Republicans and Democrats that those folks are facing discrimination.
Do you identify the one group in society that experiences the most discrimination?
We only asked about four groups in this survey, and then we actually created a scale. If folks are interested, they can check it out. It's www.prri.org. And what we see is that if you are likely to believe that one group doesn't face discrimination, you're actually likely to perceive that many groups don't face discrimination. Hmm. So you're just actually generally likely not to perceive discrimination occurring at all among any number of different minority groups. So, for instance, if you look at Republicans, roughly two-thirds say that relatively few of any of these groups, gay and lesbian people, African-Americans, or immigrants, face any type of discrimination in society, whereas Democrats largely believe that all these groups are facing discrimination.
Hmm. Daniel, talk about other findings in the survey that stood out for you as particularly important for us to know.
One of the things I think is really important is the stark generational divide that we're seeing on LGBT issues. So, for instance, while only 27% of Republican seniors support allowing gay and lesbian people to marry, a majority of young Republicans do. So this issue, I think we're seeing a consensus due to the fact that young people largely don't believe that this is even an issue. We're seeing the same thing happen among younger conservative religious communities, too, where young evangelicals are much more likely to support same-sex marriage than older evangelicals.
What were the surprises for you in these findings?
So one of the interesting things about this study is we get to look at differences among particular states. And so for this discrimination index that we created, we were allowed to look at the way Maine and New York are different than Utah and Colorado. And the states that stood out as least likely to perceive any type of discrimination against the groups that I've been talking about, we sort of thought they'd be more located in the South and Southeast, but actually it's more in the Mountain West. So the states that are least likely to perceive any kind of discrimination are North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. And this is likely due to a couple different things. One, those groups are largely white, older, and conservative, and those attributes are all correlated with not perceiving discrimination. They're also not very diverse. So you're living in those states, you're less likely to run across someone who's African American or gay and lesbian or an immigrant. And so I think that that lack of social exposure is one reason why they sort of stand out and are less likely to perceive discrimination in those states.
Looking at the big picture, do you think these findings suggest Americans are more divided or less divided than we think of ourselves as being?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's more of a good news, bad news sort of situation. When you look at some of the policy questions, particularly on same-sex marriage and religiously based service refusals, we are, I think, approaching a consensus on those issues. The amount of opposition, the nature of opposition is shifting, it's lessening. We're seeing more broad range support across a variety of different issues. Back when we first started polling on the issue of same-sex marriage, the debate was divided between religious groups and the people who weren't religious, right? Mm-hmm. So people who weren't religious supported same-sex marriage and people who were religious opposed it. And now there are religious groups on both sides. So there's many religious groups that support same-sex marriage along with people who are not. And it's only sort of more conservative denominations that are really still opposing. And there and the opposition, even among those conservative groups, has lessened. We also haven't talked about this issue yet, but there's generally broad support for immigration reform as well. And despite the heated nature of the rhetoric in the 2016 election, support really didn't vacillate much during the campaign. So we find 6 in 10 Americans say that they support allowing immigrants living in the U.S. illegally to become citizens, provided they meet certain requirements. So on some of the policy issues, we are seeing places that it's possible to build a bridge between Republicans and Democrats, between religious and the non-religious, between men and women, conservatives and liberals. But on this issue of discrimination, it seems like we are really divided. And this is probably a little thornier and not so easy to solve, because I think so much of our reality is now really being mediated by sort of self-selected preferences. So we sort of personalize what we consume and what we experience. And so we can avoid relatively easily facts that challenge our existing preconceptions. And I think that's really a central challenge, that technology has just made it so easy for us to avoid things that don't conform to what we already believe.
Yeah. Do you see reasons for hope in this?
Yeah, no, that is a really interesting question. I think it raises another perception question, right? So when it comes to discrimination and discriminatory acts, like police targeting and even killing African-American men, one of the questions that you hear a lot is, you know, are these acts increasing, or are we just seeing them more because they're on the media? Because with camera phones, it's really easy to sort of capture these kind of incidents. And so I think that's a really important question. To what extent are we seeing more of this type of activity, and to what extent is it just an artifact of it's being covered more in the media?
Right.
I think some of the government agencies that track this stuff have suggested that we are seeing more type of discriminatory acts against gay and lesbian people and Jewish Americans and Muslims. But I think that's sort of, you know, only sort of the beginning of the conversation and debate about this stuff.
Sure.
To the extent that the media is covering this stuff more, I think is really helpful, because it does give people who wouldn't be able to sort of break out of their own sort of bubble to experience something, even if it's indirectly through the media.
I don't want to miss something important, so let me ask you, what else in this research do we need to hear from you to be fully briefed on its importance?
If you think of the South as like the sort of stronghold of opposition against same-sex marriage, there are really significant differences by age. So younger Southerners are actually really supportive of same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, we're sort of seeing the inevitable consensus building on that issue. And I think what happens next will be really interesting to follow. We talked about transgender bathrooms a little bit and discrimination against transgender people. My sense is that, you know, although don't quote me on this, that the policy battles over transgender issues will move much more quickly and gain much more acceptance more quickly than the fights over same-sex marriage. I just think that, you know, the society has already taken two steps towards agreement on these issues, that I think whatever new issues emerge, transgender and whatever comes after, I think will just be, you know, two steps more towards greater acceptance of that.
Dr. Daniel Cox is Director of Research at the Public Religion Research Institute. There is a treasure trove of information and insights in the latest American Values Atlas findings, and you can read all of that online at PRRI.org. Daniel, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Evil is a word that gets thrown around a lot these days, but even as it still has power to motivate action, both for individuals and for nations, how often is it actually misapplied? And what are the moral implications of that? An enduring analysis of these questions appeared in the New York Times a year ago under the headline, How Should We Respond to Evil? The writer is the Reverend Stephen Polycus, and I am very pleased to welcome him now to State of Belief Radio. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Walton.
Stephen, would you talk about the correlation between the political rhetoric of evil state-sanctioned and violence?
In my piece, I go back to my memory of listening to President Bush's State of the Union address in 2002 when he used the term axis of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in his memoir, David Frum talks about how that phrase came to be. He originally came up with the term axis of hatred And then President Bush's other speechwriter, Michael Gerson, supposedly switched it to evil because it had more of a theological ring. And the fact of the matter is that once you call someone or something evil, you create a moral category for that thing. In this particular case, it was three states, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. And if I say that something is evil, that means that it is most definitely going to bring about suffering in the world. And so I actually have a moral obligation to destroy that thing. Mm-hmm. And when you think about the way that our policies have unfolded over the past 15 years, we really see evidence of this. I mean, it became morally imperative to take military action against Iraq to destroy this evil regime. And even now, just this week, North Korea had a successful ICBM launch, which makes it possible for them supposedly, potentially, to be able to hit the United States with a nuclear attack. We still think of North Korea policy, I think, deep down in terms of them being a part of an axis of evil. And that changes the way that we are going to interact with them. If we think that this is an inherently evil state, an inherently evil entity, then there's nothing to bargain with. There's nothing to argue with. You don't reason with evil. If we were to think about it in different terms that were perhaps not quite as theological and more policy-based, or using different theological categories, then we would probably come up with a much different policy towards these things that have now been called evil. So think about how powerful just this one word and this one concept is, that it can continue to influence our thought and even motivate us to go to war decades after such a term has been used.
Take what you've just said, take all of that, and tell us how that is mirrored at the interpersonal level as well.
Well, I became interested in this topic also partially as a gay person, thinking about how homosexuality was thought of as an evil and articulated as an evil and continues to be in Christian circles, and how there is a definite distinction between calling homosexuality evil and calling homosexuals evil. I mean, once you bring it to that realm, then once again, you have a moral obligation to destroy the person or the thing that you're calling evil. If you're calling homosexuals evil because of their being, because there's some sort of ontological aspect to who they are, that they are bringing about evil in the world, destroying families, then you really do believe that you have an obligation to obliterate them. Mm-hmm. And that's a scary thing, being on the other end of that.
Yeah.
It's a truly, truly scary thing. If you think about homosexuality being evil in and of itself, then you definitely have a moral obligation to keep that as a concept out of the public realm because it is causing evil in the world. So, I mean, that's just one example of the way that the idea of evil as it's articulated in Christian circles has a direct impact on the way that we interact with one another. Now, think about it for those of us who are in parish life or church life, who interact in spiritual communities. The moment that you get to the person that you're having a conflict with, where you start to see that person as inherently evil or there's something wrong with them, you are denying their humanity and you're denying their right to even exist because they are so opposed to what is good that there is no way that any good is going to come out of your interaction with them. That's really the kiss of death for any church community, any synagogue, any community of faith of any kind. And because I'm so familiar with this way of interacting with people in a parish setting, I'm extremely disturbed by our political climate, where we are beginning not to be able to see one another as human beings, but perhaps even as evil. I'm observing a very disturbing trend, just anecdotally online and in comments that people say on the left, because it seems that there is a debate going on right now as to whether people who supported the person that you don't think should be in power, mm-hmm. if they themselves are evil. And this is very disturbing because once we get to that place, there's no return. There's no way that any political impasse will ever be solved. Because if you believe that this person is evil and they're voting for evil interests, then compromise simply can never be met. And the only goal of political action is destruction. I worry on a regular basis as to whether our political system can withstand a force like that. So I think the best way to combat this is to have an open and honest discussion about evil, about what we know it is, about what we know it not to be, and about how to interact with it in the world, because it's there. But if we simply go around and casually ascribe the characteristics of evil to people we simply don't like or don't agree with or vehemently disagree with, if we start calling them evil, we've really gone past a level where we're ever going to be able to reconcile again.
Is it important for us to reach a common understanding of evil? And I'm relating that to what you just said, because I'm not sure, but what in at least political rhetoric, we're getting various understandings of evil.
I think that is that's a really excellent question. I think it's probably, practically speaking, impossible for all people to come to a common understanding of evil. I think that there are, however, historical precedents for people recognizing acts or events and coming to a consensus about the fact that they were evil. So think about, for instance, this liberal world order that we've been living under since 1945. It values human rights. It values globalism. It values states cooperating as opposed to being in constant competition with one another. And it values averting total war. Mm-hmm. And this was all erected, this entire international structure of global governance, as a direct response to the evils of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons why we have structures in place to try to prevent genocide and Holocaust and rampant human rights abuses. It's because there was a consensus following the Second World War that something truly horrible had happened, something evil. And they created a response to it that would be able to contain it, avoid it, mitigate it in some way, shape, or form. So there's definitely precedent for people coming to a consensus about certain acts or events or concepts being evil. That's definitely true. I'm not really sure if it's necessary for everyone to come up with a consensus, with a total agreement about what the definition of evil is. Matter of fact, I think that might be a little bit scary.
Yeah. Stephen, do you think we've made mistakes in how we've taught ethics and morality with respect to evil, or is it more a matter of an immature understanding of the concept that makes it such a powerful rhetorical weapon in our culture?
I think that we definitely need to hold political leaders and policymakers accountable for the improper or casual use of evil as a term, precisely because it is such a powerful tool. I mean, it's a little bit like a nuclear weapon in terms of political rhetoric, because as I say, once you use it, you really can't take it back, and it just reverberates for an incredibly long period of time. And it also, historically, has been shown to incite violence. So I think that creating a culture of accountability around political rhetoric, I think this would actually be a really positive and constructive step for people to engage in who are concerned about our politics today. I think our political leaders and our whole system would benefit from it for sure. One of the difficulties that we face right now, I think, as a society, is that we have so little moral and ethical formation, really. Mm-hmm. Everything from public education to formation in faith communities, we're not really getting the moral education that we need as a people. And so to have a populace that is not attuned to the importance of rhetoric and the nuances of ethics is definitely something that in the long term is going to come and hurt our society as a whole.
Has your thinking on the subject of evil changed at all during the past year with all of what we've seen going on? This week in particular, the President of the United States has spent time with world leaders that in the past might not have been identified as particularly good on this side of the Atlantic.
My thinking has definitely changed. I think one of the interesting things about taking on a topic of studying evil, and believe me, I'm just a newcomer at this whole thing compared to the giants of thought who examine evil. But in studying it, you kind of become more accustomed to horrible things, reading about terrible things that have happened in history, and it's made me actually appreciate how innocent of a time that we have lived in, and actually how innocent of a time 2017 might be, if you consider what possibly could be coming down the pike. I don't mean that to sound alarmist. It's just that human history is punctuated by pretty terrible things happening, and that is one of the things that has stimulated thought about evil itself. I think that the thing that bothers me the most is the liberal global order that was constructed after the Second World War was a practical response to evils that had been suffered throughout the world. And it was quite successful at mitigating those things, not 100%. And it also ignored many, many evils that exist in the world, everything from global income inequality to terrorism. These things were not contained by this order. But my fear is that if we're starting to go down this path of dismantling that order, that we might forget the value that it had and the ways that it kept so much of these evils out of the world. So that certainly wasn't as evident a year ago as it is today. And there are definitely debates going on within the policy community as to whether the end of this global liberal world order happened in 2016 with Brexit, with the election of President Trump, who ran explicitly against this world order. And so one of the things I fear is I think a lot about, well, what's going to replace it? And if we are going down a path where the world is changing this dramatically, it would definitely behoove the leaders and interested parties to have an informed discussion about what evils we need to prevent today and in the future.
Reverend Stephen Polycus is rector of All Saints Episcopal Church in Park Slope, Brooklyn, New York. A former journalist, Stephen published an incisive opinion column in the New York Times 1 year ago that is as important today as it was last summer. It is titled, How Should We Respond to Evil? And we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. It's also worth noting that the article will be included in a forthcoming book titled Modern Ethics in 77 Arguments, A Stone Reader. It'll be out next month. Stephen, I think this is an immensely important conversation to have, and you have done it so well. I want to thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Now, before we go, the 4th of July is one of my favorite times of the year. Typically, I love the majestic music, the patriotic rhetoric, the stunning fireworks, and the warmth of communities coming together to celebrate this special day. Some of that was true this year. I took a long walk by the bayou. In the distance, I could hear the marching music of John Philip Sousa and a young female voice singing the national anthem. I watched with joy the young boys and girls riding in their red, white, and blue decorated wagons, pushed by proud parents on their way to an annual neighborhood 4th of July parade. A fragment of emotion stirred my heart as I wiped sweat from my forehead and noticed the stillness and peacefulness of the body of water on the bayou by which I walked. But something was missing. Something so palpable I reached trying to touch it. Almost every Independence Day, I look at the art that depicts the Statue of Liberty with a tear or tears falling from the eyes of Lady Liberty. This year, I understood those paintings for the first time. If I'm honest with myself and try not to please other people by faking happiness today, I have to admit a profound sadness is shrouding my presence and muting both my laughter and my songs. Don't get me wrong. I live in the only country in the world in which I want to live. Every day that I worked in Washington, D.C., I stared at the Washington Monument, felt my heart beat a little faster as I drove by the Jefferson Memorial and looked at the Capitol building, whether up close or from a distance, with awe. These art-touched chunks of marble mean something to me. A ravenous hunger for freedom. The sacrifices that have been made to preserve freedom. The ideas and promises inherent in we the people. A devotion to justice for all people. And a commitment to true religious freedom in which there is no entanglement between the institutions of religion and the institutions of government. But it's not the same this year. I am profoundly sad because I am profoundly afraid. I hate what's happening in the highest offices of our government. The Supreme Court is changing the definition of religious freedom in a manner that is compromising the promise and the future of religious freedom. A shamefully politicized Congress is committed to partisan victories that are considered more important than the welfare of all the people in our nation. The president is an embarrassment who makes no attempt to hide the fact that his vision is to get everything he wants, even if that requires ignoring everything the people in this nation need. My disturbing, deep dissatisfaction with Donald Trump is no longer about politics alone. It's about decency. I viscerally despise his erosion of the dignity that long has been associated with the presidency. His arrogant, egotistical, and dirty-mouthed rhetoric is offensive to all that has been the best of America. His ignorance of government, insensitivity of speech, and lack of care for this nation is angering as well as disheartening. His hot-heated ways and irresponsible flares of wild emotions scare me badly when I think of the reasoned mind that is essential in protecting our freedom, guaranteeing justice, and working for peace. Not only is he egotistical, he is without reason when it comes to gun violence, a free press, which is a foundation of democracy, a lack of civility, and a respect for the history to which he will contribute stains and shame. So what do we do? Well, about 30%+ of the people cheer the president's ugly ways, thinking that his mistakes will make America great again. About 70% of the people think removing the president from his office is the quickest and most gigantic step forward toward making America great again. Citizen involvement is more important than ever. A public that shows the Congress how to move with cooperation rather than partisanship is essential. Common decency is worthy of praise and practice. Honestly, a strong conscience of shared values, courageous steps toward restoring our government, and a will to preserve our democracy are in the hands of the Republican Party. Their patriotic actions in responding severely to the president's irresponsibility is our best hope for a quick change in the nation. I wonder what that party and its president felt this week on the 4th of July. I was weeping for my country and seeking to determine what I must do to help effect change and help usher in a better day. I believe, I need to believe, that the idea and the ideals of America are greater than the forces that challenge her today. There is language in the oath of office that elected officials take which makes reference to enemies, quote, foreign and domestic. I recognize that there are Americans of goodwill who sincerely believe that this country was headed in the wrong direction, so distressing that even the behavior of our current leaders seems to them to be a hopeful change. I know that there are Americans of goodwill who feel that the most moral and patriotic thing they can do right now is resist the agenda of those same leaders and dismissing the people on the other side from whichever side you happen to be on as ignorant and destructive, evil even, demeaning and demonizing them as un-American, as enemies. The idea and the ideals of America were born in a time of great conflict. Let's not forget that. Of great danger, great fear, and great courage. The idea and ideals of America were not created for easygoing times of peace and prosperity. They were created to give freedom and independence a fighting chance at a time of suffering and deprivation. And that's a big part of where hope needs to come from today. So much of the noise we are surrounded by is being created by small people with small ideas. I want to continue struggling to believe that the big ideas that have sustained this great country for so many years will ultimately outlast these current tribulations. But of course, there's no way for that to happen unless as many of us as possible commit to understanding and defending those noble principles beyond politics, beyond party, and beyond personal agendas. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, thank you so much. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.